and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's indictment by the Department of Justice of two Russian spies in connection to the state-sponsored hacking of Yahoo in 2014 that affected 500 million email accounts. Robert Morgus, a policy analyst with the New America Foundation's Cybersecurity Initiative, joins us to discuss how the two Russian FSB officers conspired with criminal hackers to obtain names, email addresses, telephone numbers, dates of birth, and encrypted passwords of U.S. government officials, including diplomatic and military personnel. We'll also examine how the FSB regulates and protects criminal hackers and what happens to the ill-gotten gains that come from direct cyber theft or from the sale of stolen personal information. Then, with today's racially charged elections in the Netherlands and Friday's visit by German Chancellor Merkel to the White House, we will discuss how the US and Germany can proceed with their differing outlook on relations with Europe and Russia since Trump has backed Brexit, criticized NATO, praised Putin, and derided Merkel's refugee stance. James Kirchick, a journalist and foreign correspondent who is a fellow with the Foreign Policy Initiative and author of the new book, The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age, joins us to explain how Europeans are waking up to the fact that Putin's Russia is trying to do by peaceful means what the Soviet Union once threatened to do with military power. Then finally, we will speak with Christopher Swift, a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia Center for National Security Law, the author of The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad. He joins us to discuss how the impending defeat of ISIS in Mosul and later in Raqqa does not mean the end of this violent Salafist jihadi movement, and the irony that ISIS is being aided and abetted by Donald Trump's anti-Muslim rhetoric and actions. And joining us now, Robert Morgus, who is a policy analyst with the New America Foundation Cybersecurity Initiative, where his work focuses on crisis management, international relations, and cyber risk and insurance. In the past, he's authored reports on sanctions and export controls, internet freedom, and internet governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Morgus.
Thanks for having me.
So, Robert, what do you make of this announcement today by the Department of Justice that they have indicted two Russian intelligence officers from the FSB, Dmitry Dokachev and his boss Igor Sushin, who, ironically and incidentally, Dokachev works for the Center for Information Security, otherwise known as Center 18, and that's the FBI's point of contact, its liaison for cybercrime matters. And, of course, the other two were pretty well-known hackers, one in Canada who's been arrested and the other one who's been sought by the U.S. for some years. I believe he, Alexei Belin, he's actually been arrested in Russia for espionage charges. So what do you make of this sort of murky world? Because my understanding is that what happens in Russia is that, to some extent, Russia is a criminal state, and that the FSB, the intelligence services, to some extent regulate hackers, protect some, and actually may have a financial arrangement with them as well. So what's this picture look like to you?
Yeah, Ian, I mean, that's a good synopsis of what's going on. And I think the first thing to understand here is that the hacking that we're talking about with regard to the Yahoo breach actually was not a hack by the FSB, but it was a hack by these two private criminal hackers, Belin and Baratov, who all accounts, or well, the indictment's account suggests that the FSB sort of strong-armed them into leveraging their access to the Yahoo servers to hand over some information. It's worth noting that the indictments are not related to the FBI's investigation into Russian interference in the election. That's an entirely different case. And that this is the third time DOJ has indicted foreign hackers. Of course, the previous two are the PLA-5, the group of PLA hackers from China that have been accused of economic espionage, and the other case is the case of the Iranian hackers who have been accused of breaking into U.S. banks and also breaking into that dam in upstate New York that caused that big sort of kerfuffle last year. The charges include hacking, wire fraud, theft of trade secrets, economic espionage. And one of the really interesting pieces of this whole story is the sort of the fact that because there's an indictment involved, there's a strong attribution as well, especially in the wake of the DNC hack and all the conversation about who done it there. There's been a broad public conversation about attribution, and there's been a healthy amount of skepticism about who's doing what. And in this case in particular, because the DOJ is involved and there's an indictment involved, there's a strong reason to suspect that they have a relatively airtight legal argument, which suggests that the attribution level is higher than maybe the DNC attribution level. But as you noted there at the end, we've been talking about how some of our adversaries in cyberspace like to co-opt or collaborate or collude with criminal actors in this space in order to achieve some national security goals. This is a practice that we've seen rise to particular prevalence in Russia in the last few years, well, dating back beyond the last few years. And yeah, it's the type of thing that's becoming somewhat status quo and oftentimes muddies the waters when it comes to attributing directly to a state actor or something similar.
Well, it looks as though from the 500 million accounts that were affected by this breach in 2014 of Yahoo, it looks as if the FSB were only interested in about 6,500 Yahoo user accounts. And they also apparently asked the hackers to look into or to break into Google accounts as well, I guess based upon information that they had from these Yahoo accounts. So what do you think the FSB were about? Because some of their targets looked like they were in Russia, not just here in the United States.
That's correct. Looking through the target list that's listed in the indictment, it's fascinating. There's a range of folks from U.S. government officials, but also includes several Russian government officials, including folks in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, folks at the IMF and other banking officials. Russia's own ministry in charge of investigating cybercrimes is listed on the group of targets. It's unclear whether mandate coming from the top or whether there were some FSB folks going rogue there. A lot of diplomatic targets from the near abroad, some Russian journalists, and then and another really interesting piece of the target list is, quote, employees of a prominent Russian cybersecurity company. If you recall, Ian, back in, I believe it was January, news broke of an arrest of prominent Kaspersky Labs employees being arrested on treason. I think there's potentially an interesting line to be drawn between those arrests and the Yahoo data.
So there have been a number of deaths, as a matter of fact, of former KGB and FSB officers, very high-ranking ones, the Kaspersky arrests, as you mentioned, and there's also the arrest of this fellow Belin, and he's arrested on Russian charges of espionage. So it's almost as though Putin's cleaning up anybody that had anything to do with either the DNC hack or the Podesta hack or whatever else has been going on. And some of the evidence that was gotten from the Yahoo hack looks as if it was counterintelligence evidence that the FSB was looking for.
Yeah, I think there's a strong chance that the information that they gleaned from the Yahoo hack is really a counterintelligence trove. And as you mentioned, they also used some of the credentials that they took from the Yahoo breach to attempt to compromise some Google accounts. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's if those credentials and those accounts are being used for the same purposes.
So what's then the broader picture here? Because you hear about these troll farms. You know, we know that the DNC hack was handed off to WikiLeaks, but it's also pretty clear that a lot of fake news was spread. They used Macedonians and others in Eastern Europe. Can you give us a picture of the whole Russian FSB cyber efforts? Because it seems like there's a lot of different parts to it. You know, there's the troll farms, there's these targeted hackers that are obviously very good at what they do. And then there's the money. I don't know whether they share in the booty, the FSB, with these guys. It's also revealed in this Justice Department indictment that these FSB guys protected, not only protected these hackers, but actually protected them from the FSB itself. And of course, one of them actually worked for the unit that is supposed to prosecute cyber criminals in Russia.
Right. So it's incredibly difficult to discern exactly how Russia is organizing itself around cybersecurity and information security offensive operations. What we do know is that their doctrine discusses the use of computer, what we would call in the U.S. computer network operations, so basically hacking, to inform their sort of broader influence and information operations campaigns, like the one that we saw during the DNC, during the election this year. But it's also important to recognize that this particular indictment isn't directly tied to that. I mean, there's obviously the broader Russian ecosystem where we are attempting, by indicting these folks, to sort of change the calculus when it comes to the individuals tasked with conducting these network operations and these influence operations. And I would say that though this particular indictment is not directly related to the DNC case and the influence operation there, that it's definitely sort of playing on the minds of the folks at DOJ who were trying to sort of shift the calculus of potential adversaries and potential Russian hackers.
Well, the New York Times recently ran a front page story about Russia's the FSB's cyber operations and this relationship between criminal hackers and intelligence regulators, I guess is how you'd describe them. But there was one character that they named who's like the number one on the wanted list. I can't recall his name now, but he was pictured in kind of camouflage outfits holding an exotic cat, you know, like an ocelot or something. This guy apparently has thousands or millions of bots and zombies that he's gathered around the world. And explain to our listeners how that operates, how they use passive computers, thousands, millions of them around the world, to multiply their mendacity.
Sure. So they have created a series of, obviously, this large botnet infrastructure, which is generally used to or leveraged to conduct what's called a distributed denial of service attack, which essentially overloads a given server and reduces the ability of those who should legitimately be able to access that server's service from being able to do so. But in addition to that, you've mentioned sort of the troll farm. And the troll farm is less of an automated thing, more of a group of humans who have been contracted, from the sound of things, by the Russian government to help spread the messaging of the Russian government. And that's what we're seeing when we talk about, you know, the people on Twitter who are trumpeting certain pro-Russian propaganda and trying to delegitimize messaging coming out of the U.S. government and the Democratic Party as it was during the lead-up to the election.
And what's the payoff for these hackers in terms of spam? I noticed in this FBI indictment, DOJ indictment, that some of the hackers took, I don't know how many Yahoo accounts and used them for spam. Because, for example, I have on my website, ianmasters.com, listeners can contact me, but I'm having a very difficult time sorting through the legitimate mail from listeners because I get hundreds and hundreds of Russian spam and phishing every day. Most of it's in Cyrillic, but it's all Russian because I'm obviously somebody that they don't like because I'm critical of Putin.
Well, I would take that as vindication of your critique, for one. You know, it's interesting. The indictment mentioned that the contracted hackers in question for this particular case got about $100 per compromised account. It's not clear to me how universally sort of transferable that number is to the rest of the sort of botnet or the sort of troll army. But I think there's a strong chance that there's a weighted system where hackers are paid based on the types of accounts they compromise. And there's definitely an incentive structure in place for groups to compromise and access as many accounts as they possibly can.
And what is the market in spam? In other words, if you get millions or thousands of email addresses, can you essentially sell that? Because apparently one of these, Belin, in fact, according to the Justice Department, gained access to more than 30 million Yahoo accounts and sold them to facilitate an email spam scheme.
Yeah, so you can, and this is unrelated probably to Russian government efforts, but in the criminal underground, there's certainly plenty of that where individual hackers will compromise the credentials of, as you say, tens of thousands of accounts and sell those on the black market to groups that wouldn't necessarily have the technical capacity to compromise the accounts themselves, but have use for the accounts, like running a massive spam campaign. What's interesting about a massive spam campaign is that oftentimes spam is an indication of a spear phishing attack, which is a way in which a group or an individual tries to compromise an email account. They'll send you a link, and that link might lead you to a site that downloads some malware and compromises your machine. So there's an interesting sort of vicious circle there that would be good for some researchers to tease out. I haven't done a ton of work into it, though.
Well, just in closing, Robert Morgus, Senator Lindsey Graham and Sheldon Whitehouse have apparently given Comey an ultimatum to speak up about the smear of Obama by President Trump recently in his crazy tweet where he accused Obama of wiretapping and of being a bad or sick guy. And I think on Monday, Comey's going to be testifying. So obviously there's a lot going on, and Monday's testimony will have a lot to do with investigations into Russian hacking during the election. And we've got the two intelligence committees also looking into it, et cetera. So how does this story play into that broader landscape?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I would say that it's a little bit too soon to know exactly how this indictment in particular plays into that broader landscape. What is clear is that there's pressure from the legislative branch on Comey and the FBI in particular to be a little bit more transparent about what sorts of investigations they're undergoing and what they're finding. There's obviously a balance to be struck here, because you don't want the FBI disclosing too much that might tip off the people who are under investigation, but you do want to begin to have the public conversation about what exactly happened and what exactly is continuing to happen. And just as a quick plug, I want to mention that we, New America, the think tank that I work at, are having our annual cybersecurity conference on Monday the 20th, which is the same day that the intelligence committees are having their hearings on Russian interference in the election. And we will have both Senator John McCain and Rep. Langevin at the conference. Most likely we'll touch on what exactly happened in those two committee hearings. So could be interested, and I'm definitely staying tuned to see exactly what comes out of this.
Well, Robert Morgus, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Morgus, who's a policy analyst with the New America Foundation Cybersecurity Initiative, where his work focuses on crisis management, international relations, and cyber risk and insurance. And in the past, he's authored reports on sanctions and export controls, internet freedom, and internet governance. We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into today's racially charged elections in the Netherlands and Friday's visit by German Chancellor Merkel to the White House.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Kirchick, who is a journalist and foreign correspondent who has reported from southern and North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent, and the Caucasus. He is a fellow with the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington, D.C., a correspondent for The Daily Beast, and a columnist for Tablet. And his latest book just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kirchick.
Thank you for having me.
And obviously the idea that we're heading into a dark age is, if not apocalyptic, is pretty gloomy. And today, of course, elections are taking place in the Netherlands that could be very important, although I believe that even if the right-wing racist does get the most seats in parliament, it'll take a while to get a majority government going. And obviously, we got Angela Merkel coming to Washington on Friday. She was postponed because of the snowstorm. So let's begin with what's happening in the Netherlands. Do you think that there is a possibility that the Netherlands could be run by a right-wing racist?
Not in this case. I think Geert Wilders does not have nearly enough support. He's actually been sliding in the polls. And there's also the way that the Dutch parliamentary system works is that there has to be coalition governments. There's just so many parties and the vote divides amongst them. And all the major parties have come out clearly and said they will not form a coalition with Geert Wilders. So there's no chance of him being prime minister. It's very unlikely that he would be in any sort of government that would form.
And does that same situation apply in France, where it does seem that the conservative alternative to Le Pen he's just been indicted. And then you've got this Macron, this young fellow socialist who seems a bit of a neophyte, but seems to be gaining in some strength. So can Le Pen be blocked in France, do you think?
I think so. You also have a similar system in France that makes it very difficult for the National Front to gain power. I mean, there's a first round and a second round. And so while she may do well in the first round, she may even get the highest amount in the first round. It's unclear. It's highly unlikely that she would win in the second round. And we're seeing already in the second round polls that she would lose by, 2-1 margin to Emmanuel Macron. So at least at this election, it's unlikely that Marine Le Pen would win. Obviously, as we've learned in the era of Brexit and Trump, you never say never. There are things that could happen. Terrorist attacks, financial crises, who knows, that might come to her benefit, but I think it's highly unlikely.
And let's turn then to Germany. Angela Merkel's seeking a fourth term. She's also, as we mentioned, her trip was postponed, but she'll be in Washington meeting with Donald Trump on Friday. That's got to be a pretty prickly meeting. Not that Merkel's not used to prickly meetings. I mean, when she met with Putin, he deliberately brought out this big dog, and because he knew that Merkel was terrified of dogs. And there's this extraordinary picture of Putin smirking while Merkel is kind of rearing back in her chair in horror at this huge dog.
Yeah, she's dealt with Putin, so I'm not so worried that she'll be able to handle Trump. But this will be a very big meeting because clearly the Europeans are very concerned about the statements Donald Trump has made about NATO, about Russia, and she's going to want to get a commitment out of him that the U.S. stands committed to NATO, that it stands committed to Article 5, which is the Mutual Defense Clause, and also, I think, more importantly, on the issue of protectionism. Germany has a huge trade relationship with the U.S., as does the EU collectively, and there's been some very protectionist messages coming out of this administration, and I think she's going to want to get to try to convince Donald Trump that this is not in the interests of the United States to throw up, trade barriers.
So, James Kirchick, you had a recent piece in Politico where you talked about, in effect, the new sort of Berlin under siege by Putin. And one of the phrases you use, which apparently is commonly used now in Germany, is Putin-Versteher. Literally translated, it means a Putin understander, but it means a Putin sympathizer. And that the article basically was suggesting that there's a lot of pretty fertile field in Germany for those that could be swayed by Russian propaganda, which is being unleashed at this very moment. So where does that stand in terms of Merkel, who certainly has no illusions about Putin, and people like Gerhard Schroeder, who's one of Putin's best buddies, the former head of the Social Democrats?
Right. So the relationship between Germany and Russia is very complicated. And in the immediate aftermath of the Ukrainian crisis, you saw very high numbers of Germans basically sympathizing with the Russian position. And that number decreased dramatically after the Malaysian Airlines flight was shot down and the Russians just, denied reality. And you saw a swing in public opinion. But there still is, as you say, fertile ground. I mean, there still is It's a combination of historical guilt over World War II that the Russians are very good at exploiting. It's a sort of pacifism that many Germans feel over their historical legacy. It's the energy and the business relationships that exist between Russia and Germany. All these factors contribute to a political environment that is much more conducive to Russian propaganda and Russian narratives than probably any other country in Western Europe. And I'm afraid now that with the election of Donald Trump, it will make those narratives and those messages easier for the Russians to push, because it puts pro-American Atlanticist leaders like Angela Merkel in a very difficult position, where she's now going to have to convince a German public that is already maybe wary of America and its motives, is even more so now that Donald Trump is president. And it's going to make the Russian narrative of, you know, well, maybe Vladimir Putin isn't that bad of a guy compared to Donald Trump. It'll make that narrative more attractive.
So what is then the glue, if you will, that connects these people that, like Nigel Farage, who is widely despised in the UK, but yet he's able to sort of stroll into the White House at any time. And curiously enough, he was meeting with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy the other day when that massive data dump of CIA hacking tools came out from WikiLeaks. Then you got Stephen Bannon. I understand this kind of white nationalism, which is, of course, one of the things that's so difficult to understand here in the United States, why European and American leftists are sympathetic to Putin, because in the American political context, he would be further to the right than Rick Santorum in terms of his anti-gay, anti-just about everything, and very pro-fundamentalist Christian in terms of his ties to the Orthodox Church, which is extremely reactionary in Russia. So what explains that, do you think? I mean, I know you just made the case why the Germans might be sympathetic to being manipulated by Putin, but why the American left?
Yeah, it's a very fascinating question. And in particular, as we've seen, Vladimir Putin's cultivating the far right in many countries and places, including in the United States. He's also been able to maintain the far left, not only in America, but also, I would say, you know, the left party in Germany, Syriza. And I think what ultimately ties it all together is basically an old-fashioned sort of anti-Americanism or anti-imperialism that sees American power as ultimately being the most destructive and evil force in the world. And this is how I think you get someone like Assange, who is probably, you would know more about this, I think he probably comes from sort of Australian anarchist left-wing tradition, maybe. And that's how you can get someone like him on the same boat, as Farage, who's on the right, and then Putin, and say the Nation magazine in the United States. I think the one kind of connecting thread is this sort of deep suspicion, even animosity towards the United States as a global power.
Right. But during the election, it was pretty clear that the Russians were feeding that narrative that if Hillary Clinton's elected, we're going to have a new nuclear war, which was coming from Russia. And you know, Jill Stein was sitting at the table there with General Flynn and Putin for the 10th anniversary. The Greens also in the election were pushing that narrative, which, I mean, it's bad enough having gangsters in charge of nuclear weapons, which is one of the most amazing phenomena in geopolitics, that you have a combination of organized crime and national security, nuclear weapons and the mafia. But that's the reality of Russia. That's bad enough to have to deal with. But the idea that he can make these threats of nuclear war, I mean, at least I think deterrence still works as far as I last checked. But it's amazing to see how well that played in the elections. I mean, there's a lot
of reasons. And even during with the WikiLeaks disclosures that were released right on the eve of the Democratic National Convention, that showed some favoritism for Hillary Clinton in the primary against Bernie Sanders. I think a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters and people on the left, they didn't really understand that this was all part of a Russian influence operation, and they basically just sort of lapped up the disclosures in the same way, frankly, that the right lapped up the disclosures when Donald Trump wanted to use the WikiLeaks information and to attack Hillary Clinton. Both the right and the far left in this country seem to ignore or just not seem to be concerned about the fact that they were really being used as useful idiots in a Russian influence operation.
Well, of course, now we have this peculiar topsy-turvy political world where the political left that normally was very leery of the CIA and blamed them for a lot of what went wrong in the world are now hoping that the CIA can provide the evidence to impeach Trump. And then on the right, the cold warriors on the right who normally hated the Soviet Union and Russia making excuses for Putin. So it's pretty hard to navigate.
The most egregious example of this in the latter has to be Dana Rohrabacher, who was a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan. He's a congressman from Orange County, California, rock-ribbed Republican. I even think he spent a few weeks in the 80s fighting with the Mujahideen against the Soviets. And now, 25, 26 years later, he is the most slavish defender of Vladimir Putin in the U.S. Congress. It is really appalling. And just to see him, he was at a hearing last week, and he was interrogating the former president of Estonia, which is a small democracy that's a member of NATO and the EU, and they've been repeatedly threatened by the Russians. And he was basically saying that, Russia presents no threat to the Estonians, and they're just exaggerating this because they want to get into war with Russia. So it's, as you say, it's just a remarkable topsy-turvy political time that we're in.
So, I guess unless you can come up with some explanation, I'm still mystified, frankly, what motivates people like Dana Rohrabacher. But look at some of the evidence, for example. One of the points that you make in the Politico article is that what Russia was unable to do during the Cold War, they're doing through, I guess, what their version of soft power, which seems to be working. But how much is Putin both the fireman and the arsonist? Because my recollection is that the massive influx of refugees into Europe, and particularly coming out of Syria, that outflow began shortly after the Russian military intervention in Syria, and in conjunction with Assad, these people wouldn't have been able to leave Damascus or even the country itself unless Assad decided to let them go. And they were encouraged to get out, and this massive flow of refugees, as we all remember in 2015, went into Europe. And that is a cause of a lot of discontent and friction, and the very thing that's being exploited by Putin in these.
The Russians are engaging in kinetic warfare along the European periphery in Syria. They're bombing massive amounts of civilian targets, and that leads to a migrant outflow. And where do those people go? They go to Europe. And the coming of these people, it leads to the rise of the far right, which is able to capitalize on this, and simultaneously the Russians can exploit it. They can weaponize the refugee crisis by hyping stories of migrant crimes, migrant rape, and this is not to downplay the fact that there have been a lot of problems associated with migrants in Europe, and certainly with the assimilation of migrants and the place of Islam in Europe. This is a serious question, but the Russians are trying to exploit this and exaggerate it through their media outlets, their disinformation outlets, and they're basically giving sustenance to the far right in Europe, who are exploiting and taking advantage of a problem that the Russians have directly contributed to, which is the instability in the Middle East.
So, again, why is it that this obvious strategy is not clear? My understanding of Putin is that he was basically a wannabe kind of spy, because the talented KGB people were sent to Washington and London and other NATO capitals, and certainly not Dresden, and that he has this, Glavny Protivnik fixation, which is the KGB's term for the main enemy. And so that seems to be his framework. He's not doing anything but destroying Russia and looting it, along with the Siloviki, his cronies. And they use these wars to distract their own people from the looting that's going on. And their main project is just to hold on to power by whatever means they can. But the one thing that seems to animate him and focus him, he's very good at stitching up the Americans. He's pretty bad at helping the Russians.
Yeah, I think we underestimate, though, the power of these narratives in Russia. I think that in Russia, the government, the leadership, and to a large degree the people, they derive pride, not in the ways that, say, most other countries derive pride, but they derive pride really in the extent to which they can oppress and humiliate their neighbors. And so I really do think that this reassertion of Russian power is a reflection of that. And there's just a great deal of resentment and anger over the collapse of the Soviet Union. And you mentioned Dresden. That's where Vladimir Putin was when the Soviet Union collapsed. He was watching
Germans take back their freedom in a Soviet satellite state. Perhaps if he had been in Moscow witnessing the newfound freedoms that his fellow Russians were enjoying in the period of perestroika, maybe he would have a different interpretation of the collapse of the Soviet Union. But that's not where he was at the time. And I think he was deeply shaped by that experience in Dresden.
Right, but the Soviet Union was the only empire where the people on the periphery had a higher standard of living than the people back home. I mean, that was the bizarre thing, that Russians used to love to be posted in Prague and places like that. That's like going to the Riviera or somewhere, you know?
Well, I think there was maybe even, like I said, there's maybe even they almost seem to have preferred having an empire, even if it meant lower living standards back home. Just the maintenance of this empire was so important to them that they were willing to sacrifice for it. And that seems to be the case now in Ukraine and Syria. They are enduring economic hardship. There are sanctions that have been placed on Russia because of these activities. But they haven't stopped the Russians from continuing the war in Ukraine and from maintaining the annexation of Crimea.
Well, my understanding, though, is that Navalny's latest video of how much money Medvedev has squirreled away, and he's a small potatoes compared to Putin, that's got an enormous amount of hits. And I spent a lot of time in the former Soviet Union, and the people were just absolutely fed up with the communists, who are a bunch of crooks, and they used the word mafia. They referred to them as a mafia. They had all the privileges, and everybody else was lining up for, you know, stringy bits of meat in empty shelves in supermarkets. And that was the reality. And they finally got rid of these crooks. And now I understand is that they're slowly starting to, I mean, when Navalny talks about United Russia being the party of crooks and swindlers, isn't that beginning to resonate with, even though Putin has high ratings, there's still this other reality that they know that these guys are stealing. They're all multimillionaires, and they loathe the oligarchs. And it seems like Russia, if you look at the headline today with the hacking of Yahoo, I mean, it is a criminal state.
Absolutely. But I still think, even though the Russian people know this and they're aware of it, I'm not sure how much it transforms into opposition to the regime. Because I do think there's a genuine level of popularity for Putin in spite of what the people know about him. So I'm not sure how much that information really affects Putin's popularity ratings.
Well, just in closing then, obviously we have somebody in the White House that is just, it's shocking to think that this man is president of the United States, that he doesn't appear to have little to no knowledge, no morality, no ethics, no ideology, and he just seems to have a kind of attitude that everything is a business deal. And I recall the first time he showed any foreign policy creds was early in the campaign, in the first few days, where he introduced the press to a bag man for General Praboa, which is this crook general related to the Suharto clan who've looted Indonesia. And he was talking about how, you know, we can't wait to make some great deals with Indonesians. So, I mean, it's astounding. So that's the mentality of this guy. And that's probably why Putin's just another one of these crooks that you can deal with. And it's
I think there's no, with Trump, there's no appreciation for the role that values play in American foreign policy. Uh-huh. It's all about, you know, deals and strength. And he doesn't seem to understand, you know, why we have alliances with fellow democracies like Japan or Germany or South Korea. Those are the three countries that I think he attacked the most during the election campaign. They're very strong allies of the United States that share our values, because he seemed to think that we get ripped off by them. So he doesn't, again, and I think that may even be a function of his disordered personality. I think he doesn't have genuine friendships. Everything is transactional with him, and that applies largely to his view of world affairs.
Well, I guess your sequel then is going to be The Coming Dark Age in the United States, right?
We'll see. It's a little early. We'll see.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, James Kerchick.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Kirchick, as a journalist and foreign correspondent who has reported from Southern and North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent and the Caucasus. He's a fellow with the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington, D.C., a correspondent for The Daily Beast and a columnist for Tablet. And his latest book just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing the impending defeat of ISIS in Mosul and later in Raqqa. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Christopher Swift, who's a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia's Center for National Security Law. His latest book is The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Swift.
Ian, good to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Christopher. And much is being made of the impending fall of Mosul. It does appear that the remnants of the Islamic State fighters are sort of holed up. Some reports are that they're in disarray and some of their leaders have been killed. But I think one has to be pretty leery about the idea that once Mosul falls and then even Raqqa falls, somehow the Islamic State is finished. What's your sense?
I think you're right with that, Ian. And look, let's not confuse a successful operation against a city with the elimination of the adversary. If anything, over the last several years, the Islamic State, or ISIS, as I prefer to call it, because I'm not quite sure how Islamic they actually are, has shown that it's capable of growing and adapting and changing as circumstances have changed around them. Now, they've lost a lot of territory over the last several years. Much of that territory, unfortunately, has been empty desert. The fall of Mosul is a pretty important development on the road to Raqqa and as part of the campaign of taking away the state-like qualities that ISIS likes to claim. But at the end of the day, even if you were to destroy their capacity to govern in a particular place like Mosul or like Raqqa or in some of the other territory that they control, it's very easy for an organization like this to revert back to the sort of non-state-centric transnational terrorist operations that we've seen them engage in the past. In fact, these are their roots, and the notion that they would try to localize themselves in places like Raqqa and Mosul shows that they grew, but it also shows that they have something to fall back on, and that fallback position for them is one that's potentially quite disruptive both for us and for our allies in the region.
Well, of course, the term that people in the neighborhood use for ISIS or the Islamic State is Daesh. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the fact that we can't even agree on what to call our enemy, ISIL, ISIS, Islamic State, Daesh, it almost is an indication that we we haven't exactly got a handle on this situation. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, more important, the terminology is symptomatic of a broader problem that we have in the global war on terrorism, and that is not just the failure to name the enemy, but to define the adversary, to explain what kind of adversary we're dealing with, and then distinguish that adversary from, say, other forms of Islamic militancy found elsewhere in the world. One of the things that made ISIS remarkable was its ability to transition from being a transnational terrorist organization to being something like a state, to setting up a system of taxation, setting up infrastructure, setting up governance. Part of that was more press release than it was actual governance. But, you know, look, they don't need to govern the territory that they controlled in order to rule it. You can rule just as effectively through fear, and we've seen plenty of regimes do that in the past. The difficulty, though, is, you know, when we talk about whether something is a state or not a state, it doesn't matter whether or not they're a state actor or a non-state actor. You have to look at what they're doing and how it threatens our interests. And in that respect, you know, the fact that we may take Mosul is the first step in a long road to deal with this particular organization and the causes that give rise to these kinds of organizations in the greater Middle East.
And what is the situation vis-a-vis Raqqa, which is their headquarters? And of course, I understand ISIS lost this very important town called Dabiq, which has all kinds of Islamic and mythical status to them. I think it's in the Hadith, not in the Quran.
Not in the Quran itself.
So they lost that town, right?
They've lost a lot of territory in the last couple of years, Ian. And they've lost it for a number of reasons. The first has been a pretty aggressive air campaign led by the United States and its allies in the region. The second has been ISIS's, the fact, you know, they simply got overextended. They got out over their skis. They did not have the ability to consolidate all the territory they took. And that's working against them. And that's also something, a phenomenon we've seen with other Salafi jihadi organizations that have tried to take and hold territory. The closest example being al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which took several provinces in southern Yemen back in 2011, 2012. But, you know, when confronted with a conventional army, fell apart in much the same way that ISIS is falling apart now. But look, their narrative has taken a beating. Their territory has taken a beating. Their leadership has taken a beating. Their recruiting is not quite as strong as it used to be. But like any one of these organizations that's come up through, you know, transnational operations and that relies on small teams of highly motivated individuals to carry out most of their activities, they don't necessarily need a big state infrastructure to be very disruptive. Look, ISIS was one of the most disruptive forces in both Iraq and Syria before it ever declared itself the Islamic State. And losing its quote-unquote proto-state status doesn't change the threat that the organization poses.
So when the U.S. envoy, Brett McCurk, says ISIS is trapped, Colonel Dorian, who's the U.S. military spokesman in Baghdad, said very few, if any, of the enemy are going to escape. You do get reports that they've actually captured some people. Some of the foreign fighters are very disillusioned, etc. So I think the more interesting question is, what has held them together all this time? You're getting pounded by air power and sort of corralled into the old city of Mosul. It would seem to me that that might be a more useful thing to try and figure out. What is the attraction? Why did these young people come from Europe? And can it be extinguished militarily?
Well, let's answer the last question first, which is, can it be extinguished militarily? When an organization is based around an ideology or a vision of a future world that's somehow better than the world we currently live in, it's very hard through purely military instruments to break down that kind of an organization. You've got to have a political element to your strategy. You need to have an economic and even an ideological element to your strategy. Certainly you'll hear that message coming out of the Pentagon just as strongly as you'll hear the message about the success that they are currently having in conjunction with their Iraqi allies on the ground in Mosul. If we look at the second question you posed, Ian, that is, what is it that draws people into these organizations? That's a pretty important question, and it's not a question just for organizations like ISIS. It's also something that's applicable to organizations like al-Qaeda or even some of the sort of self-styled lone wolf jihadi operations we've seen carried out here in the United States on U.S. soil. And there's basically four different pathways that bring individuals from where they are in life into an organization, or at least lead them to take actions on behalf of an organization, even if they're not actually a member. The first is the direct recruiting of the kind that we saw al-Qaeda use in the run-up to 9/11. The second is sort of this mediated online radicalization that you see a member of an organization like Al-Qaeda or ISIS engage in. And the best example there is their Anwar al-Awlaki's radicalization of Major Nidal Hassan, which led to the Fort Hood shooting. In that instance, you've got someone sort of bringing somebody along. Another example is an individual becomes sort of a free agent for an organization. The Times Square bomber, Faisal Shahzad, is a good example of that. He went to Pakistan, received training from the Pakistani Taliban, never actually joined the organization, but took the training that he got, came back to New York and tried to blow up Times Square. That's sort of the third pathway. And then the fourth pathway is sort of the purely self-directed, self-radicalization process. And the best example there are the Tsarnaev brothers up in Boston with the Boston Marathon bombing. Here you've got two kids who, you know, their one parent is from Chechnya, the other parent's from Dagestan. They grew up in Kyrgyzstan, no history of radicalization whatsoever until their lives start to go sideways. And when they radicalize, they do so not with a focus on the country that they're from, not on a focus on, you know, Chechnya's struggle against Russia and vice versa, but they're focusing on Iraq and Afghanistan because those are the images they're resonating with online. So four different pathways, four different very complicated ways that individuals can get pulled into organizations. There's a lot of psychological factors involved in addition to ideological ones. And one of the things that we're not getting as part of our struggle against quote-unquote global terrorism is the role that these psychological factors play in terms of motivating people and allowing them to be, and making them vulnerable to recruitment. We focus a lot on the ideology, but we don't necessarily focus on the psychology. There's a reason why some people are more vulnerable to this and some people are less vulnerable. Generally speaking, the people who are less vulnerable are the ones who understand their religion well, who have a strong foundation in a community that cares about them, who have economic opportunity, and who tend to be employed and married. Oh, and by the way, if you look at the places where terrorist organizations as a whole tend to be less successful, especially the Al-Qaeda and ISIS-type organizations, they're in communities and countries where none of those factors play, where things are in flux and you don't have strong institutions, including an absence of strong religious institutions.
Well, Christopher Swift, the New York Times reported that has been up at the front in Mosul with the Iraqi army, and I believe there are also a number of U.S. Special Forces and Marines that are also there pretty close to the front lines. She was just saying yesterday on NPR that some of the captured ISIS fighters were saying that they consider Donald Trump a blessing to them because of his Muslim ban. How much is, just in terms of what you just said, I mean, it does seem that this particular new government we have here in the United States seems to be talking tough, but its actions in terms of a Muslim ban, my understanding is that it, in other words, the way I see it is that the American Muslims and Muslims around the world that aren't radicalized, in other words, the only people that can dissuade a young Muslim from becoming radicalized are their fellow Muslims. And it would seem to me that the front line in the battle against this ideology, as you point out, it's an ideology, are the very people that we should be nurturing and supporting. And do you believe that our current government is undercutting that effort?
I do. More importantly than what I believe, take a look at what the U.S. Department of Defense has been telling the White House. The reason why Iraq has been removed from the latest iteration of the Trump administration's travel ban is specifically because this plays exactly the wrong way while we're on the ground, shoulder to shoulder, with our Iraqi allies trying to deal with this adversary. Those aren't my words. That's analysis coming out of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We're not, the most liberal left-wing organization in the United States. Look, Ian, I've spent the last 12 years looking at the evolution of radical Islam in various conflict zones around the world. And one of the things that benefits organizations like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or other iterations of the Salafi jihadi virus that's sort of infected Sunni Islam over the last 20 years, one of the things that they try to do in every instance is create a binary view of the world. It is either you are with the Crusaders, and the imperialistic, capitalistic West that doesn't understand Islam, or you are with us and there's no middle ground. When we take actions that collapse the distinctions between different groups in the Middle East, or that assume that a particular religion carries a political ideology rather than a set of cultural and theological frameworks that people use to understand their lives, when we try to boil everything down into black and white, we take away all that middle ground. And the middle ground is where the future of this fight is going to be won, not just on the ground in terms of our forces and our ability to operate with allies in some of these countries, but also in the communities that are going to decide whether they're going to support us and support a view of the world that's based on human dignity and equality, or whether they're going to support a view of the world that is, shall we say, antediluvian in its outlook and separates people based on what category they decide to assign us to. I don't mean to oversimplify things, but the problem here is the Trump administration is oversimplifying things, and in the process, they are closing down options rather than creating one. And I don't care whether you are a strategist or a military officer or a business person or an attorney. If you're a smart person, you're looking for how to create options, not how to narrow them. At the bottom end of the day, Ian, the policies the Trump administration is adopting reflect a particularly pernicious view of the world that doesn't hold it doesn't align with my experience in the region or my interactions with people from the region. It's contrary to what the State Department and Defense Department have advised, and it's primarily designed for a U.S. domestic audience. I think when it comes to foreign policy and national security, we really need to be looking at facts on the ground in foreign places rather than trying to pander to a particular part of the U.S. electorate.
Well, just in closing then, Christopher Swift, who's in charge? I mean, apparently Donald Trump has appointed his former real estate lawyer, David Greenblatt, who has no political or Middle East experience, to be in charge of the Middle East peace process, if that's indeed the portfolio that extends to this region that we're talking about, is a complete neophyte. He's also in charge of Cuba for some other reason as well.
Part of the reason it doesn't jump out to me is because most of the people who know this region really well,
right,
either on the defense side or on the diplomacy and economic development side, have either not taken jobs with the administration or have not been eligible to take jobs with the administration because they had the temerity to criticize the Trump campaign. Those are Republicans, not Democrats. And so, look, the only way to do this stuff right is to have people who've been on the ground and understand what's going on from a local perspective, in addition to understanding how U.S. foreign policy and national security works. At the moment, with the exception of the generals who are currently running the National Security Council and the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense, we really don't have a lot of those positions filled. And so if folks are not held over from the Obama administration, we don't have a lot of that continuity. And a lot of those holdovers are people who are patriots first and, partisans second, to the extent that they're partisan at all. The fact that Brett McGurk has been held over is very encouraging because he understands this stuff really well. But I can't tell you, Ian, what's filtering up into the Oval Office. What I can tell you is that Steve Bannon can walk into the Oval Office at any particular time, but the president's own national security advisor, who is one of the best generals you could possibly hope for in the United States, does not have the right to walk into the Oval Office and advise the president if there's a crisis. He has to go through someone like Bannon first.
Well, Christopher Swift, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's good to be with you, Ian. Happy to help anytime.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Christopher Swift, who's a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia Center for National Security Law. His latest book is The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.